2. He was 26 years old when he first met Jones. It was April 4th, 1995. He always remembered that day. The spring air was cool and full of the smell of new growth. The war had ended the year before. Ahead of him spread out a long descending slope. Houses were perched here and there, mostly privately constructed shelters, temporary and flimsy. Crude streets, working-class people wandering. A typical rural region that had survived, remote from industrial centers. Normally there would be the hum of activity, plows and forges, and crude manufacturing processes. But today, a quiet hung over the community. Most able-bodied adults and all of the children had trudged off to the carnival. The ground was soft and moist under his shoes. Cusick strode eagerly along because he, too, was going to the carnival. He had a job. Jobs were scarce. He was glad to get it. Like other young men intellectually sympathetic to Hoff's relativism, he had applied to the government service. FedGov's apparatus offered a chance to become involved in the task of reconstruction. As he was earning a salary, paid in stable silver, he was helping mankind. In those days, he had been idealistic. Specifically, he had been assigned to the Interior Department. At the Baltimore Antipol Center, he had taken political training and then approached SecPol, the security arm. But the task of suppressing extremist political and religious sentiment had, in 1995, seemed merely bureaucratic. Nobody took it seriously. With worldwide food rationing, the panic was over. Everybody could be sure of basic subsistence. Wartime fanaticism had dwindled out of existence as rational control regained its pre-inflation position. Before him, spread out like a sheet of tin, the carnival sat assembled. 10 metal buildings displaying bright neon signs were the main structures. A central lane led to the hub, a cone within which seats had been erected. There the basic acts would take place. Already he could see the first familiar spectacle. Pushing ahead, Cusick made his way among the densely packed mass of people. The odor of sweat and tobacco rose around him, an exciting smell. Sliding past a family of grimy field laborers, he reached the railing of the first freak exhibit and gazed up. The war, with its hard radiation and elaborate diseases, had produced countless sports, oddities, freaks. Here in this one minor carnival, a vast variety had been collected. Directly above him sat a multi-man, a tangled mass of flesh and organs. Heads, arms, legs wobbled dully. The creature was feeble-minded and helpless. Fortunately, his offspring would be normal. The multi-organisms were not true mutants. "Golly," a portly, curly-headed citizen behind him said, horrified. "Isn't that awful?" Another man, lean and tall, casually remarked, "Saw a lot of them in the war. We burned a barn full of them. A sort of colony." The portly man blinked, bit deep into his candied apple, and moved away from the war veteran. Leading his wife and 3 children, he meandered up beside Cusick. "Horrible, isn't it?" he muttered. "All these monsters." "Yeah, sort of," Cusick admitted. "I don't know why I come to these things." The portly man indicated his wife and children, all of them stonily gobbling up their popcorn and spun sugar candy. "They like to come. Women and kids go in for this stuff." Cusick said, "Under relativism, we have to let them live." "Sure," the portly man agreed, emphatically nodding. A bit of candied apple clung to his upper lip. He wiped it away with a freckled paw. "Well, they got their rights just like everybody else. Like you and me, mister, they got their lives, too." Standing by the railing of the exhibit, the lean war veteran spoke up. "That don't apply to freaks. That's just people." The portly man flushed. Waving his candied apple earnestly, he answered,
Mister, maybe they think we're freaks. Who says who's a freak?
Disgusted, the veteran said, I could tell a freak. He eyed Cusick and the portly man with distaste.
What are you? He demanded. A freak lover?
The portly man sputtered and started over, but his wife seized his arm and dragged him away into the crowd to the next exhibits. Still protesting, he disappeared from sight. Cusick was left facing the war veteran.
Damn fool, the veteran said. It's contrary to common sense. You can see they're freaks. My God, that's why they're here.
Well, he's right, though, Cusick pointed out. The law gives anybody the right to live as he pleases. Relativism says...
Then the hell with relativism. Did we fight a war? Did we beat those Jews and atheists and Reds so people could be any damn kind of freak they want? Believe any kind of egghead trash?
Nobody beat anybody, Cusick answered. Nobody won the war. A small knot of people had stopped to listen. The veteran noticed them. All at once his cold eyes faded and glazed over. He grunted, shot a last hostile look at Cusick, and melted off into the group. Disappointed, the people moved on. The next freak was part human, part animal. Somewhere along the line, interspecies mating had occurred. The event was certainly lost in the nightmarish shadows of the war. As he gazed up, Cusick tried to determine what the original progenitors had been. One, certainly, had been a horse. This freak, in all probability, was a fake, artificially grafted, but it was visually convincing. From the war had come intricate legends of man-animal progeny, exaggerated accounts of pure human stock that had degenerated, erotic tales of copulation between women and beasts. There were many-headed babies, a common sport. He passed by the usual display of parasites living on sibling hosts. Feathered, scaled, tailed, winged humanoid freaks squeaked and fluttered on all sides. Infinite oddities from ravaged genes. People with internal organs situated outside the dermal wall. Eyeless, faceless, even headless freaks. Freaks with enlarged and elongated and multi-jointed limbs. Sad-looking creatures peeping out from within other creatures. A grotesque paranorma of malformed organisms. Dead ends that would leave no spawn. Monsters surviving by exhibiting their monstrous qualities. In the main area, the entertainers were beginning their acts. Not mere freaks, but legitimate performers with skills and talents, exhibiting not themselves, but rather their unusual abilities. Dancers, acrobats, jugglers, fire eaters, wrestlers, fighters, animal tamers, clowns, riders, divers, strong men, magicians, fortune tellers, pretty girls, acts that had come down through thousands of years. Nothing new. Only the freaks were new. The war brought new monsters, but not new abilities. Or so he thought. But he hadn't seen Jones yet. Nobody had. It was too early. The world went on rebuilding, reconstructioning. Its time hadn't come. To his left glared and winked the furious display of a girl exhibit. With some spontaneous interest, Cusick allowed himself to drift with the crowd. Four girls lounged on the platform, bodies slack with ennui. One was clipping her nails with a pair of scissors. The others gazed vacantly at the crowd of men below. The four were naked, of course. In the weak sunlight, their flesh glowed faintly luminous, oily, pale pink, downy. The pitchman babbled metallically into his horn. His amplified voice thundered out in a garble of confused noise. Nobody paid any attention to the din. Those who were interested stood peering up at the girls. Behind the girls was a closed sheet-tin building in which the show itself took place. Hey, one of the girls said. Startled, Cusick realized she was speaking to him.
Do what?
he answered nervously. What time is it? The girl asked. Hurriedly, Cusick examined his wristwatch. 11:30. The girl wandered out of line over to the edge of the platform.
Got a cigarette? She asked.
Fumbling in his pocket, Cusick held up his pack.
Thanks.
Breasts bobbing, the girl crouched down and accepted a cigarette. After an uncertain pause, Cusick reached up his lighter and lit it for her. She smiled down at him, a small and very young woman, with brown hair and eyes, slim legs pale and slightly moist with perspiration.
You coming in to see the show?
She inquired. He hadn't intended to. No, he told her. The girl's lips pulled together in a mocking pout.
No? Why not?
Nearby people watched with amusement.
Aren't you interested? Are you one of those?
People around Cusick tittered and grinned. He began to feel embarrassment.
You're cute,
the girl said lazily. She settled down on her haunches, cigarette between her red lips, arms resting on her bare, out-jutting knees.
Don't you have $50? Can't you afford it?
No, Cusick answered, nettled. Can't afford it.
Oh.
Teasing, pretending disappointment, the girl reached out her hand and rumpled his carefully combed hair.
That's too bad. Maybe I'll take you on free. Would you like that? Wanna be with me for nothing?
Winking, she stuck out the tip of a pink tongue at him.
I can show you a lot. You'd be surprised, the techniques I know.
Pass the hat.
A perspiring, bald-headed man on Cusick's right chuckled.
Hey. Let's get up a collection for this young fella.
A general stir of laughter drifted around, and a few $5 pieces were tossed forward.
Don't you like me?
The girl was asking him, bending down and toward him, one hand resting on his neck.
Don't you think you could?
Taunting, coaxing, her voice murmured on,
I'll bet you could. And all these people think you could, too. They're gonna watch. Don't you worry. I'll show you how.
Suddenly she grabbed tight hold of his ear.
You just come on up here. Mama'll show all of you people what she can do.
A roar of glee burst from the crowd, and Cusick was pushed forward and boosted up. The girl let go of his ear and reached with both hands to take hold of him. In that moment, he twisted his way loose and dropped back down in the mass of people. After a short interval of shoving and running, he was standing beyond the crowd, panting for breath, trying to rearrange his coat and his savoir-faire. Nobody was paying attention to him, so he began walking aimlessly along, hands in his pockets, as nonchalant as possible. People milled on all sides, most of them heading toward the main exhibits and the central area. Carefully, he evaded the moving flow. His best bet was the peripheral exhibits, open places where literature could be distributed and speeches made, tiny gatherings around a single orator. He wondered if the lean war veteran had been a fanatic. Maybe he had identified Cusick as a cop. The girl exhibit had been a sort of all man's land between freak and talent. Beyond the stage of girls stood the booth of the first fortune teller, one of several.
They're charlatans,
the portly, curly-haired man revealed to him. He was standing with his family by a dart-throwing booth, a handful of darts clutched, trying to win a 20-pound Dutch ham.
Nobody can read the future. That's for suckers.
Cusick grinned.
So's a 20-pound Dutch ham. It's probably made of wax. I'm gonna win this ham,
the man asserted good-naturedly. His wife said nothing, but his children displayed overt confidence in their father.
I'm going to take it home with me tonight.
Maybe I'll get my fortune told, Cusick said.
Good luck, mister,
the curly-headed man said charitably. He turned back to the dart target, a great eroded backdrop of 9 planets pitted with endless near misses. Its virgin center, an incredibly minute Earth, was untouched. The portly, curly-headed man drew back his arm and let fly. The dart, attracted by a deflecting, concealed magnet, missed Earth and buried its steel tip in empty space a little past Ganymede. At the first fortune-telling booth, an old woman, dark-haired and fat, sat hunched over a squat table on which was arranged timeless apparatus, a translucent globe. A few people were lined up on stage, crowded in among the tawdry hangings, waiting to pay their $20. A glaring neon sign announced, "Your fortune read, Madam Lulu Karima Zelda. Know the future. Be prepared for all eventualities." There was nothing here. The old woman mumbled through the traditional routine, satisfying the middle-aged women waiting in line. But next to Madame Lulu Karima Zelda's booth was a second booth, shabby and ignored. A second fortune-teller, of sorts, sat here. But the bright glaring cheapness of Madame Karima Zelda's booth had faded. The glittering nimbus died into gloomy darkness. Cusick was no longer walking through the shifting artificial fluorescent lights. He was standing in a gray twilight zone between gaudy worlds. On the barren platform sat a young man, not much older than himself, perhaps a little younger. His sign intrigued Cusick. "The future of mankind. No personal fortunes." For an interval, Cusick stood studying the young man. He was slouched in a sullen heap, smoking angrily and staring off into space. Nobody waited in line. The exhibit was ignored. His face was fringed with a stubbled beard, a strange face, swollen deep red with bulging forehead, steel-rimmed glasses, puffy lips like a child's. Rapidly he blinked, puffed on his cigarette, jerkily smoothed back his sleeves. His bare arms were pale and thin. He was an intent, sullen figure, seated alone on an empty expanse of platform. No personal fortunes. An odd come-on for an exhibit. Nobody was interested in abstract fortunes, group fortunes. It sounded as if the teller wasn't much good. The sign implied vague generalities. But Cusick was interested. The man was licked before he started, and still he sat there. After all, fortune-telling was 99% showmanship, and the rest shrewd guesswork. In a carny, he could learn the traditional ropes. Why did he choose this offbeat approach? It was deliberate, obviously. Every line of the hunched, ugly body showed that the man intended to stick it out, had stuck it out for God knew how long. The sign was shabby and peeling. Maybe it had been years. This was Jones. But at the time, of course, Cusick didn't know it. Leaning toward the platform, Cusick cupped his hands and yelled, "Hey!" After a moment, the youth's head turned. His eyes met Cusick's. Gray eyes, small and cold behind his thick glasses. He blinked and glared back without speaking, without moving. On the table, his fingers drummed relentlessly. "Why?" Cusick demanded. "Why no personal fortunes?" The youth didn't answer. Gradually, his gaze faded. He turned his head and again glared down sightlessly at the table. There was no doubt about it. This boy had no pitch, no line. Something was wrong. He was off key. The other entertainers were hawking, yelling, turning themselves inside out, often literally, to attract attention. But this boy simply sat and glared. He made no move to get business, and he got none. Why, then, was he there? Cossack hesitated. It didn't look like much of a place to snoop. Actually, he was wasting the government's time. But his interest had been aroused. He sensed a mystery, and he didn't like mysteries. Optimistically, he believed things should be solved. He liked the universe to make sense, and this blatantly flaunted sense. Climbing the steps, Cossack approached the youth.
All right, he said. I'll bite.
The steps sagged under his feet, a rickety platform, unstable and unsafe. As he seated himself across from the youth, the chair groaned under him. Now that he was closer, he could see that the youth's skin was mottled with deep splotches of color that might have been skin grafts. Had he been injured in the war? A faint odor of medicine hung about him, suggesting care of his frail body. Above the dome of his forehead, his hair was tangled. His clothes clung in folds against his knobby frame. Now he was peering up at Cossack, appraising him, warily studying him, but not fearfully. There was an awkward crudeness about him, an uncertain twitch of his gaunt body, but his eyes were harsh and unyielding. He was gauche but not afraid. It was no weak personality that faced Cossack. It was a blunt, determined young man. Cossack's own cheery bluster faded. He felt suddenly apprehensive. He had lost the initiative. $20, Jones said. Clumsily, Cossack fumbled in his pocket.
For what? What am I getting?
After a moment, Jones explained. See that? He indicated a wheel on the table. Pulling back a lever, he released it. The hand on the wheel slowly turned, accompanied by a laborious metallic clicking. The face of the wheel was divided into four quarters.
You have 120 seconds. Anything you want to ask, then your time is up.
He took the change and dropped it in his coat pocket.
Ask? Cossack said huskily. About what?
The future.
There was contempt in the youth's voice, undisguised, unconcealed. It was obvious, of course. The future. What else? Irritably, his thin, hard fingers drummed, and the wheel ticked.
But not personal, Cossack pursued. Not about myself.
Lips twitching spasmodically, Jones shot back. Of course not. You're a non-entity. You don't figure. Cossack blinked. Embarrassed, feeling his ears begin to burn, he answered as evenly as possible.
Maybe you're wrong. Maybe I'm somebody.
Hotly, he was thinking of his position. What would this rustic punk say if he knew he was facing a FedGov Secret Service man? It was on the tip of his tongue angrily to blurt it out, to give his role away in self-defense. That, of course, would finish him off with security. But he was harried and uncertain. You're down to 90 seconds, Jones notified him dispassionately. Then his gaunt, stony voice took on feeling.
For God's sake, ask something. Don't you want to know anything? Aren't you curious?
Licking his lips, Cossack said,
Well, what's the future hold? What's going to happen?
Disgusted, Jones shook his head. He sighed and stubbed out his cigarette. For a moment, it seemed as if he wasn't going to answer. He concentrated on the smashed cigarette butt under the sole of his shoe. Then he dragged himself upright and carefully said,
Specific questions. Do you want me to think up one for you? All right, I will. Question, who'll be the next council chairman? Answer, the nationalist candidate, a trivial individual named Ernest T. Saunders.
But the nationalists aren't a party. They're a cultist splinter group.
Ignoring him, Jones went on.
Question, what are the drifters? Answer, beings from beyond the solar system, origin unknown, nature unknown.
Puzzled, Cossack hesitated.
Unknown up to what date? He ventured.
Plucking up his courage, he demanded. How far can you see? Without particular inflection, Jones said,
I can see without error over a span of a year. After that it fades. I can see major events, but specific details dim, and I get nothing at all. As far as I can see ahead, the origin of the drifters is unknown.
Glancing at Cusick, he added,
I mention them because they're going to be the big issue from now on.
They already are, Cusick said, recalling the present sensational headlines in the cheap press. Unknown flights of ships detected by outplanet patrols.
You say they're beings, not ships?
I don't get it. You mean what we've sighted are the actual living creatures, not their artificially constructed?
Alive, yes,
Jones interrupted impatiently, almost feverishly.
But FedGov knows it already. Right now, at high level, they have detailed reports. The reports will be out in a few weeks. The bastards are withholding them from the public. A dead drifter was hauled in by a scout coming back from Uranus.
Suddenly the wheel ceased clicking and Jones dropped back in his chair, his flow of agitated words ceasing.
Your time is up, he announced. If you want to know anything more, it'll be another $20.
Dazed, Cusick retreated away from him, down the steps and off the platform.
No thanks, he murmured. That's plenty.